Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with John Wells. Well, math tutor and science writer David Darling wasn't offended much when his 12-year-old student took home Darling's 450-page encyclopedia of math, brought it back the next week, not only having read it, but having found several errors. Darling wasn't offended, but amazed, and has since teamed up with that student to write a book called Weird Math, A Teenage Genius and His Teacher Reveal the Strange Connections Between Math and Everyday Life. Now, that student is Agnico Banerjee, and both he and his tutor hail from Scotland. What's extra special about Agnico is that his IQ happens to be 2 points higher than that of Stephen Hawking or Albert Einstein. How many Mensa IQ points is that? 162. We're pleased to be joined by both Agnico and David. Welcome you two to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, Lynn. How are you doing?
Wonderful. Well, David, let's start with you. And I would like to go back a few years. I think about 5 years when you first met Agnico. Tell us the story and how you two came together.
Well, as well as writing science books, I've always done tutorials in math and science. I've always had a few private students. And Agnico's dad called me one day and said that we're basically having trouble stretching Agnico because school's running out of things to do with him, and we just really don't know what to do. So if there's any way you could help and try and push him in different directions, because he's just so far ahead of his age group. So I said, fine, you know, bring him around, and we had a chat. And I started with the usual, you know, giving him basic mental problems to do. And we quickly moved on to ridiculously complex calculations, which he was doing in his head. And it was obvious that his breadth of knowledge was tremendous. And I was a little bit nervous because I'd never had a student this bright before. I mean, he really is on a different planet in terms of his thought processes and his memory as well. And as you mentioned, I loaned him one of my books, this big, thick maths encyclopedia I'd written a number of years ago. And he took it home, and as you say, he brought it back the next week. And I was a bit disappointed at first. I thought maybe just skim through it or look to the pictures or something. And he said, oh, I've read it. He said, I found a few mistakes in it. And I checked through them, and sure enough, every one of them, about four or five of them, very, very tiny details, but every one of them he spotted. So I knew then that I had somebody very special that I was dealing with.
Oh, yeah. Well, Agnico, let's hear from you. Now, it sounds to me that for a 12-year-old to have this system of math already in his head is something very, very important. But talk to us a little bit about, first, your interest in math, your initial interest in math, how old you were, and then how it came so easy to you.
Well, as for my initial interest in math, it developed at a very early age. As in, I was probably about 3 or 4 when I first started to notice that I was good at math in particular. And in school, when I was about 7 years old, I was regularly moved up several years to do math. And it came to a point where in primary school, which is what essentially grades 1 to 7, that in primary school I did what was then called standard grade. It's the equivalent of a GCSE in England, or what do you have in the United States?
Okay. Agnico, I wanted to ask you, let me just first state, as I observe and look out on our world here, I see a lot of things, but I don't see them in mathematical terms. Do you do that when you look out across a mountain range or look at a bed of flowers? Do you think about how prime numbers might be determining how many, or how prime numbers are somehow associated with the number of petals or the number of pieces of this world that you look at?
Well, in the case of flowers, actually, it's not really prime numbers. In the Ace of Flowers, it's Fibonacci numbers that determine the number of petals in a flower. Mm-hmm. And there is actually a reason for that mathematically. And it's to do with the fact that, obviously, when a flower is growing, its petals would obviously be spaced out regularly. And there are mathematical reasons behind how that leads to the Fibonacci numbers.
Okay. Because I was just amazed in reading your book about some of the associations between prime numbers and our world. For example, the cicada on a 17-year cycle, 17 is a prime number. What other associations have we been able to, yourself, but all of us through the age of time, what other associations with prime numbers have we discovered?
Well, in general, I'd actually say that these occurrences, it's quite rare that you'll find a pattern and then just might be able to obviously ascribe the prime numbers, because these types of mechanisms aren't really that common.
Mm-hmm.
In that certain patterns, like that of the prime numbers, don't seem to be naturally occurring very often. But sometimes when, for example, there's a reason due to evolution of them being naturally occurring, as in the case of the cicadas, then of course we can find the patterns and study them mathematically. But in terms of patterns like that,
right,
I'd say those types of patterns were completely discrete in that manner.
Okay.
Are not that common. But
well,
really, if you look at patterns in continuous processes, I'd say they're a lot more common.
Okay. David, a question for you to sort of button up this series of questions. You all write in the book that Platonists believe that math just exists. And so are they saying that man did not invent math but discovered it? In other words, did the world around us present math to us, or did we actually discover it?
Of course, that's an age-old question, isn't it, John? Is math invented or discovered? I think most mathematicians work under the assumption that math is out there. For example, the number pi, it exists somewhere, whether we're thinking about it or not. And before humans came along and if you like, figured out what pi was, it was somewhere there. And I often have discussions with Agnijo about this, and he believes along those lines that math basically exists out there, and I kind of go along with him as well. But the question is, where do these things exist before humans had realized them, if you like? Where is pi when we're not thinking about it? Where is pi in the external world? And I think it's my view is that it's a sort of a combination, really, of what's out there and the human mind together. Whereas I think Agnijo is more of a Platonist, thinking it's kind of out there somewhere. And I think the sticking point is, well, exactly where is it? If you can't actually say where it is, then that's the philosophical debate.
Right. David and Agnijo, I have to frankly admit that I have never pondered where pi is out there in the universe. But hopefully with a book like yours, Weird Math, I think what you're trying to do is introduce people to what you find so fun about math. And so why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, we all chalk things up to dumb luck sometimes, or just something random. We that's an expression that we say, well, that was random. But how do you relate math? This is one of the chapters in your book. And how do you bring that fun into showing us about the math behind chance?
Behind chance. Do you want to answer that one, Agnijo?
Well, yes. A key point is that with chance and randomness, our intuitions are very often misleading. But the maths will often be very surprising. But for example, there are some very famous examples, like if you have 23 people in a room, there's approximately 50% chance that two of them have the same birthday. That's something that's quite surprising, but you can work it out using the maths, and you will actually get the right answer that way, but people don't expect that. And that's why some things in the study of probability can be so unintuitive, because the human brain was not supposed, like, it didn't evolve to deal with accurate probabilities like these, but rather rough, intuitive ones. So,
yeah, I get that. David, would you like to add to that?
I think randomness is one of these things that we sometimes, as Nijo says, we don't really have a good feeling for what it means. And the interesting question is whether anything is truly random in the universe. If you take, for example, going back to pi again, you know it starts off 3.141 and then it just goes on forever. It's an infinite series of numbers. Now, you can't predict what the next one's going to be. You can run a computer and you can work out pi to a million or 10 million places, but you won't know. There's no way of predicting what the next one is. So it's effectively random. If you wanted to have a good random number generator, for example, it would be figuring out the next digits of pi. But pi exists. It's not going to change. So once you've figured out what those numbers are, they're no longer random, because then if you work out pi again, it will still come up as the same number. So there's a very interesting question of whether actually anything in the universe is truly random.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Agnieszko Banerjee and also with David Darling. The two of them have teamed up to write a book, Weird Math, A Teenage Genius and His Teacher Reveal the Strange Connections Between Math and Everyday Life. We were in the green room talking before the show began, and I was thinking that we were going to have sort of a technical conversation about math, and I'm fascinated that it's really sort of a philosophical conversation we've had so far. You know, is the universe random and chaotic, or is it perfect and orderly with pi and with traditional geometry? I have to ask you guys a question, and that's in your book you have a bit on Kurt Gödel, and I know I have not pronounced his name properly, but he has written a number of equations, but one equation that proves that God exists. And in this equation, there are several symbols in this equation I've never even seen before. But was this a humorous attempt on Kurt's part, or was he serious? And what does the equation tell us?
Well, the symbols actually fooled the publisher as well. They asked us several times to check them because they thought they were mistaken. And we did check that it was actually the symbols that Gödel intended. Yes, he did intend it to be a serious logical argument. As far as whether it proves the existence of God or not, you've got to look at the assumptions he made, and some of those assumptions are pretty dodgy. So although if you take his assumptions to be based in some sort of sound foundation, yes, it's okay. But his initial assumptions are questionable. But Gödel, of course, was a logician, and he was using this form of symbolic logic to make a theological point. He was actually quite religious in some of his beliefs, so I think he was trying to introduce logic into religion and provide a convincing case. Want to add to that?
Well, yes, I'd say that well, from a logical standpoint, it's okay. When you look at the proof, it's an interesting point in math that whenever you work in math, you start with a set of axioms, and those are your starting assumptions. And to do any math, you always have to have axioms. So with Kurt Gödel, while his proof, logically, it worked, that's what you've got to look for. You've got to look at the axioms and see whether they actually were like with ordinary arithmetic, which is known as Peano arithmetic. We've got very basic axioms like for every number, there's a number that comes after it.
Right.
This is just the natural numbers. That's Peano arithmetic. So we can see, we can judge these axioms to correspond to the real world. But with Kurt Gödel's supposed proof, if you want to say that the proof is flawed, then where you've got to look is the axioms. And yeah, the axioms are, in this case, quite dodgy assumptions.
Well, math, of course, is all about proof. And so we're not just talking about just some vague assumptions. The axioms are ironclad statements that are rock solid. They have to be rock solid. They have to be accepted by the mathematical community. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. But you're free to choose what axioms you want. So you can build whole different systems of math depending upon the starting assumptions. And so you can build, if you like, imaginary worlds or various worlds in mathematics depending on your initial assumptions. Some assumptions seem so obvious that they're never questioned, but other times mathematicians will introduce other arguments, other axioms, and build an entirely different argument based on them.
Mm. Fascinating. I want to ask either of you this question, although it's centered around Agnijo. And in researching you for this interview, of course, your reputation precedes you as having an IQ that's 2 points higher than Albert Einstein or Stephen Hawking. And I'm sorry that that is the way that you are introduced. I mean, it's wonderful on one hand, but it creates this expectation about how you move through life and who you are. And I would assume that that it's a blessing and sometimes a curse. In connection to when I Googled your name, articles came up about things like, oh, people with high IQ have no common sense. And I would imagine that people try to degrade you. And of course, that's out of some odd envy or something like that. But I wonder if you both could comment on your experience of having this tremendously high IQ. Agnijo, why don't you start?
Well, first I'll start by saying that with IQ, it's not really the best measure of intelligence per se. It's considered to be like a measurement of just one component of intelligence. But in terms of the common stereotype that people with high IQ have no social skills and are essentially nerds, I think that that's a case of how the media portray people with such high IQs. That turns out to be a very common media portrayal that people with high IQs don't have social skills.
Right.
I would agree with Agnijo there. I don't think it really has any bearing on anything else. I think, first of all, the measurements of IQ are highly suspect and unreliable, and I think it's a pretty one-dimensional way of comparing people. I have noticed that very, very bright mathematicians tend to be extremely focused mm-hmm. because they're passionate about what they do. And however you look at math, it is a difficult subject, especially when you get to the levels that Agnijo is working at. And so if that is your passion, you do tend to be almost fully consumed by it. In the same way, I think, that genius musicians are. That's the universe in which they tend to exist, and they are surrounded by other like minds, if you will. So in some ways, they can seem unusual. However, that's just the nature of what they do is that it's all to do with the focus and the passion that comes from their high ability. And of course, the more they get into the subject, the more involved they get, the more focused they tend to be.
Mm, Well, I certainly envy that level of focus and passion. It's a wonderful thing to hear about. I'm also curious, we tried to book you a week or two ago, and Agnesia was attending some sort of math, or as you say in the British Isles, maths, plural,
yes.
Which I think is a curious distinction. But
well, actually, we have a separate edition of Weird Math. It's called Weird Maths over here. The U.S. edition, they dropped the S. Which,
do you have any idea why we dropped the S?
No. And if you Google it, you'll get all kinds of arguments. I think it's a very long, convoluted story. So I think it's whatever you're most used to, really.
I like it. So, Agnesia, you attend these math competitions around the world. Could you describe sort of what goes on at these competitions?
Well, with math competitions, there's for people around my age, people still in secondary education, there's one major math competition, and that's the International Maths Olympiad. And that will actually be in July. I don't yet know if I'm on the team for that at the moment, but I'm in the selection process. But the one that I've just been to was a Balkan Mathematical Olympiad. And the UK is obviously not a Balkan country, but it was a guest country at the event. So basically what happens is that like an exam, you're given a set of problems, except there aren't that many problems. Usually, depending on which Olympiad, there are three or four of them. In the Balkan Mathematical Olympiad, for example, there are four problems. You have just 4.5 hours to solve as many as you can. But to compensate, these problems are very difficult problems, and it's always a case of, like, just brute force calculation will not be enough. You have to have the problem-solving skills in order to do this. It's very much a problem-solving competition.
Well, we've all seemed to talk ourselves into the fact that math is difficult, that it's boring, that you can't do it, and all that. And I'm reading your book, and I have my basic geometry and trigonometry and all that. And I want to know for people like me that kind of struggle with math, what can we do to be able to bump up our understanding of some of these more complex arrangements that you've spoken of, that you have written about?
Well, I think that's why we wrote the book, in a way, because most people's experience of math is simply what they do in school. And you know, quite frankly, that can be quite boring for most people. For one thing, they can't see the point of a lot of it. I mean, most of us, once we've left school, apart from doing calculations, arithmetic, we don't use algebra. We don't really use geometry much either. So a lot of people think, well, what's the whole point in it? And that's really why we wrote the book, because there's far more to math than that. In fact, there's a whole universe out there that involves all kinds of interesting concepts, like infinity. You know, is it taught much about infinity in school, or higher dimensions, or, as we've already touched, the mysteries of prime numbers, for example, or very, very large numbers, or bizarre geometries, or fractals. All of this stuff you can read about, and of course that's why we wrote the book, really, was to give people a taste for the adventure of mathematics and the wonderful nature and weird nature of the subject that goes far beyond what we mostly experience in school.
Yeah, and just as we were speaking earlier about pi being out there before we all discovered it, what else is out there that is obvious or somewhat obvious, but we have not discovered it yet? And I'm hopeful that with predictive analysis, self-learning, the artificial intelligent pieces of big data and algorithms that take a look at large data sets, that there will be some other things out there that we can find, and who knows where it's going to take us. What are your thoughts on that?
My feeling is that the more we know, and this is true in science in general, is that the more we realize we don't know. the extent of the mathematical universe becomes more and more clear to us. Just as looking into the physical universe, we realize about things like dark energy and dark matter, which we don't really understand and we didn't even know about a few years ago. So there are many, many unsolved problems in mathematics that we still need to work on. And when we've solved those, it will open up whole new areas again. And as you say, for example, artificial intelligence may become important in the solution of some of these problems, but there will always be new problems to tackle in the future.
Well, what I say is that it's probably instructive to look at a previous unsolved problem, although a problem that was actually unsolved and one of the biggest problems in math until fairly recently. It was solved in 1995. However, it was posed by Pierre de Fermat, a famous mathematician, in the 1600s. And it was referred to as Fermat's last theorem. It seems a very simple problem in that, obviously, Pythagoras' theorem, a squared plus b squared equals c squared. What Pierre de Fermat was asking is it possible to replace the squares with cubes or fourth powers or any higher powers and still get a to that power plus b to that power equals c to the power, where a, b, and c are whole numbers? That's the problem. And Pierre de Fermat thought that there were no such solutions, that it was completely impossible with any power higher than the square.
And
he wrote the problem and then said, I have a marvelous proof of this, but this margin is too small to contain it. And so, no one knows if he did have a proof, and to be honest, he probably didn't, but it tantalized mathematicians ever since, and it was only solved in about 1995. That's when the solution was approved, and the math behind that solution, though, was so complicated that it involved entire new fields of mathematics that Fermat could have no way of ever knowing about.
Wow. Well, an illuminating conversation here, and we're so glad that the two of you could join us all the way from Scotland. The book is Weird Math, A Teenage Genius and His Teacher Reveal the Strange Connections Between Math and Everyday Life. David Darling and Agnesio Banerjee, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Bye.